Welcome to the Banking Reinvented podcast. Every week, we discuss how banks can progressively modernize their customer journeys and model business operations around their customers. You're listening to Tim Rutten, and I'll be joined by Backbase CEO and founder Jouk Pleiter and other senior banking leaders from around the globe. Ready to unpack how to re-architect banking together? Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone, to a new episode of Banking Reinvented, where today we are joined by Max Flototto from McKinsey, senior partner and co-leader retail banking globally and all things fintech. Max, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be with you.
Likewise. And Jouk, also good to see you here as well.
Yeah, great. Good to be here. Good to see you.
And for today, we are going to discuss anything and everything related to retail banking together with Max here in the call. And maybe to kick things off, what is most top of mind for you at this moment in time, Max, before we move into the questions?
What is most top of mind for me? If I'm very honest, we are standing here a few days before the Christmas break. And if I look at my calendar and the list of presents I still haven't yet organized, I get sort of nervous. So right after this podcast, I will jump out of my office and try to catch up on some of these. That's most top of mind, if I'm very honest. Other than that, I think it's an exciting time in banking and fintech. I mean, there's a lot going on. If he's on the fintech side, funding coming back, some interesting M&A discussions, the first steps towards IPOs. That's very exciting. With my incumbent clients, lots of challenges, but also tons of opportunities coming also from tech. And I think we'll dive into this today. So exciting times. However, I am nervous about those presents.
We will get to those presents after the pod.
Excellent.
It's good to see you set priorities, Max. That is encouraging.
Indeed. All right. So let's kick off with the first, discussion topic, which is all about where are retail banks today in terms of profitability and what are the main challenges, Max?
So we looked at this in detail just a few months ago. In a global effort. And now retail banking is a super local business, right? As you are, I think, also struggling with that in your own business, it's very different to work with retail banks and say, you know, the German market, which I know well, the Nordics, North America, or Latam, these are completely different markets. But we did see quite a few patterns. I mean, overall, retail banks have gone through 10, 12, 15 very difficult years. With in the low interest rate environment, with very low structural profitability on some of their core products, and in many markets, really not earning their cost of capital. Now, more recently, many have shown their best results in history, or at least in many, many years, and are sitting on record profits driven largely by the tailwinds coming from the interest rate increase, which isn't fully passed on through customers, which is an incredible boost, of course. So it is clearly a position of strength for retail banks. Again, different market by market, but generally speaking, I think that is very, very clear. However, it doesn't mean there's no challenges given where we stand today. And I mean, should we go into those directly? I mean, maybe we shouldn't start off on too positive a note, but there's a ton of things to do, right? I mean, there's a cost inflation on the personnel side. There's increasing cost from just keeping up the existing tech. I'm not even speaking about investing into new tech. So the share of tech investments as part of the expense base keeps going up. For most institutions, we see an increasing amount of cost related to fraud and financial crime in many markets, to an extreme extent in the UK, but also also broadly. And we see all that in the context of margins that will not continue to be at the level they are today, even if we do believe in a higher for longer scenario with high interest rates for longer. Just by the path through of interest to customers on the funding side, margins will go down at some point. And all of that puts pressure on the bottom line. And banks need to act. It's very clear.
If you don't mind me asking, a few episodes ago, we were
in a conversation with Mayur Vichari. He's leading our value consulting efforts here internally. And he was making a statement. It's a rather blunt statement. So let's see how you digest it. But he said, this is basically fake growth already for a few years because nothing has materially changed in the business. The operating model hasn't changed. The technology patterns haven't per se changed. So if they want to sustain that growth, and if there's going to be, let's say, less influx on the interest side of the house, you're going to get into a squeeze. So still, there should be a sense of urgency to actually do make progress now that you are in this position of strength. How does that resonate with you?
Well, maybe I wouldn't be quite as blunt. Also, I'm not Dutch, right? So I'm very direct, but not quite as direct as you guys are. But I think there's for sure a kernel of truth in this, and probably more. I do think these massive tailwinds in at least some institutions are, you know, covering up a lack of transformation efforts and a lack of efforts both on in terms of driving efficiency, really going for the benefits of scale, which is very difficult if you work in a complex operating model, and also looking for new growth on the fee side and so on. So many banks have not really been able to drive fee income and have just benefited massively from the increase in NIM, so net interest margin. So I think that's true. And we haven't yet even spoken about competition, which is massively accelerating for at least not all segments and not all customer needs, but in many customer needs, banks are now facing tremendous competitors that they weren't facing 5 or 10 years ago. There's a big need to move and a big need to change things.
What are the major type of competitors you see emerging, MX, and why are they dangerous?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends segment by segment, right? If you start on the retail side, there are the big neobanks that we all talk about, read about, probably use to some extent. My kids are still too young; they're 9 and 10, but I'm pretty sure they will be banking with one of these in the future. That's one, and those have grown up, right? They are it has really focused on a few players that are showing fantastic growth, that are starting to penetrate their customers more broadly, and that are starting to have a more healthy also revenues per user or per customer. So that's one. Number two, you have tons of specialists that go after attractive segments. Think about this online brokerage trend with millions of new brokerage customers that came into the market during COVID and since then. And these customers are not banking with the universal banks. They are with a new breed of brokers. You look at consumer finance or a buy now, pay later. Now, there's a lot of discussion of whether this product by itself is profitable. And I do think it can be, right, given its effect on basket size and conversions on the merchant side. And so there's a ton of opportunity. But either way, again, it's something where there's specialists going super deep and going after attractive segments. And also on the corporate banking side, I mean, speaking of the German market, which I probably know best, sort of attractive segments within corporate banking have been strategically and persistently attacked by foreign players coming into the market that don't even attempt to cover everything, that don't attempt to have the full network everywhere, that go only after the nice niches and show very high profitability there. So we see in many markets a structural decline in market share of local universal banking players towards new attackers, towards specialists, towards non-banks, towards online comparison platforms, and so on. So there is competition coming from all sides. Nevertheless, banks also have a very, very strong position, right? Customer trust, big customer base, super sticky business. I mean, we all know banks open shop on January 1st and they already know 80% of what's going to happen on their P&L in a given year, which I don't think is true for many, many, many industries. banking continues to be, if you add up profits of all banks globally, the most profitable sector ahead of tech and anything else at a global scale. So banking is a fantastic business, but it's highly competitive, not surprisingly. And these competitors have grown up.
Yeah. So if you then look at the board, like from your vantage point, like what is the level of urgency on the why change or change now?
It differs. I think some have clearly understood it and are investing heavily into upping the game. And we can talk about some of the things that they're doing. Some have understood it, but struggle to find the right things to do. Maybe they're lacking scale. Maybe they say we would like to do this, but at our scale with our customer base, we can't really afford to do it. Maybe it's too complex. And there's certainly a third group that is living in La La Land and is enjoying great numbers and boasting about their success. Well, if I see that, I continue to be polite, but I do see that some of that is based on a false premise and surely not going in the right direction. And there's also a group of leaders in some institutions who maybe rationally says, well, I have 3-4 more years in this role. Now change is coming, but it won't fundamentally disrupt our position in 3 years, and someone else will take care of these difficult choices thereafter. It's only human, but it's surely something that we see.
Moving on, Max, what are the winners doing? So where are the main opportunities for that profitability and that growth long term?
So, I mean, it really, again, depends on the market context and which institution we are talking about. There's not one answer for this. But there's a bunch of things, I think, that are relevant throughout. One is a more granular approach to growth, both in terms of thinking about which segments and parts of the market you want to go after, what offering is core to what you want to do, and what maybe isn't. And then even one level deeper, much smaller segments of customers that you go after in what we call hyper-personalization, where you really almost talk on a one-to-one level with customers, which is something that wasn't possible just a few years ago. And now the help of advanced analytics and the help of Gen AI can be done. And we're seeing significant upside from doing this. So on the growth side, that's surely one thing. And it's often linked with balance sheet light businesses, driving fee income and all this. Another thing is on efficiency. We do see massive upside. You guys know 10 times more than I about tech. But this whole question of modernizing legacy tech with AI-supported replatforming and so on is something that can be done significantly faster and at lower cost than years ago, and will allow for a modernization of many institutions. Secondly, we still see massive operations and customer service, customer support units in many banks, where there's tons of upside from using AI, using chatbots, voice bots, which are just in a different scale now. We all remember 10, 12 years ago, there was this chatbot hype. And I probably have also been in a meeting or two where I was speaking about it. And we all, hated it as customers. We just hated it. They were not good enough. And we all got frustrated, throwing our laptop against the wall when the stupid chatbot wasn't getting the point. And many have hence ramped that down and gone back to traditional customer service. But I think we're now living in a world where this is possible. And the performance I'm seeing at my clients in the first sort of steps towards using it is incredible. I was just in a demo yesterday of a company with a voice bot doing live conversations in multiple languages you know, incredible, showing empathy, having the right information at hand, fantastic intent recognition, knowing what to do. And, you know, if you can be scaled infinitely. And can that cover every customer need? No. Do customers still want to, you know, meet a person they know and trust for some conversations? For sure. Do you need that to change your account number? 100% no. And so on these dimensions, we see some moving very, very fast and others being more cautious.
If I may ask, let's say a double-click question. You mentioned hyper-personalization, segmentation, going very granular where you feel as an institution you can grow. So where do you see the opportunity? Theoretically, I think that is a very solid way to move forward from here on out. But to actually practically implement this within a bank, what are the main challenges that you're picking up on?
Oh, well, how much time do you have?
Until Christmas presents become a problem, Max.
If Jaap takes care of my Christmas presents, we can stay a bit longer, Tim.
All right.
some of it is technical, right? Being able to plug this into existing technology, existing workflows, and so on. I think that, I mean, you guys are the experts here. These days is a lot easier than maybe 10 years ago, right? I think banks are a lot more prepared to add another layer on top of what they have. The API-fication has made big progress, and I think that's easier. It's still hard work, but it's much easier. I think the bigger constraint is aligning a large set of different stakeholders internally. There's a ton of things to think through in terms of data protection and customer consent. Right? Can you even, you know, are you allowed to address your customers with certain things? There's a ton of concern from risk and compliance about giving wrong information. Who is responsible if the AI gives wrong info, which leads to bad decision making on the part of the customer? And that takes a lot of time. So we've done a couple of projects on tons of projects on this, and the ones where I've been involved in. A lot of time gets spent on, you know, working intensively with risk and compliance to understand what they look at, what could go wrong, and just making sure this doesn't happen. There's one interesting thing though. In one case, the AI was giving quite a bit of wrong info, and we always spoke about, oh, it's hallucinating, and this is the issue, blah, blah, blah. Now, what we figured out is the AI was using information from the bank systems, which was outdated and wrong, because the systems weren't up to date, and the FAQs weren't up to date. So a customer doing his own research or her own research would have also found the wrong information, right? So it wasn't the AI's fault, it was the fault somewhere else, and it's actually good that they found it, right? Anyways, that's a kind of constraints and hurdles I would see.
Thanks for sharing. Moving on, we move to the topic of primacy. So basically going for a strategy where you're the primary bank for the given end user, whether it's a consumer or a business context. Why is that becoming even more important, would you say, Max?
I mean, it clearly is the thing banks are talking about. And I think the understanding is that winning customers in the market is very expensive, right? You are, I mean, especially we talked earlier about an increasing degree of competition. There are some very well-funded companies. They used to do this with, you know, cheap VC money, and now they are doing it based partially at least on their own profitability, and they're investing heavily in winning customers. So winning a customer is tough. So once you have a customer, you want to keep her and turn that into a mutually beneficial relationship as much as possible. And that goes through primacy. And that means you want to be the bank for your customers. And that primacy share is something that is, for many banks, it's quite low, actually. And not only for the neobanks, even for incumbent banks. They have, you know, if you really look at the customer base in detail, look at the number of products, the number of transactions per week, per day, the number of touch points. For many banks, there's a big chunk of their customer base which is really only a customer, you know, in name and not by their action. And that's a massive missed opportunity. And so what I'm seeing is that this idea of primary customer, and they use different words, right? Primary mobile, active mobile, active. There's different definitions internally. That is becoming maybe the most important KPI in many retail banks. That's because the economics are as they are. Winning a customer in her mid-20s and keeping them for the next 20 years is a fantastically profitable relationship. Winning a customer in the mid-20s and then losing the same customer at age 28 and trying to regain her when she's 32 and, you know, in the market for her first mortgage is economically insane. And you keep paying middlemen and, you know, it's...
What tactics did you see kind of to really help drive primacy or increase product holdings?
Yeah. So a couple of things. I think one is it's really stepping up the understanding of the customer base by understanding needs, understanding also triggers in people's lives where these things happen. Because banking products are not something you don't wake up in the morning and want to increase the number of banking products that you own. That's not what you do. You have some other need in life where banks can enable you. And you do want to understand that as much as possible from the information that you have, from conversations you've had with the customer, from transactions you see, you know, maybe suddenly the monthly income has gone up from a new job. Maybe suddenly someone starts moving money off their account somewhere else at regular frequency. All these things you can learn something from and never have a trigger point. That's one.
I may interrupt you for a moment. Like, I'm always a little bit skeptical because I know these banks have been data scientists and segmentation like for decades. Maybe I'm the only unfortunate person on the planet, but I never see anything intelligent from various financial service providers in my daily life. So I know the theory, but
it is not easy. But I would disagree with you. I've seen tremendously successful hidden affluent campaigns, for example, right, where you say you have a customer who doesn't do much with you. And in your segmentation, the customer is a mass affluent and you really, your main focus is to lower cost to serve and make sure you don't spend time on the customer. And, you know, I'm simplifying, but that's a good, you know, you want to keep the customer happy, but you don't want to invest too much time. But really the customer is has inherited a lot of money, has maybe applied for a mortgage with you a few years ago, didn't take it in the end. Probably they got a mortgage somewhere else. Right, so they probably own real estate, which for most people is the largest financial asset. It's maybe sending off money once a month from your account somewhere else. So, you know, understanding that and then going after these customers with a targeted proposition, you know, doesn't get you conversion rates of 50-60%. Of course not, but it is possible and is a lot higher chances of being successful than trying to find these customers in the open market, right? That's one thing. Or just one more thing, or just churn prevention, right? I talked about how important it is to win and keep customers. You know, understanding the early signs of a customer shifting business away from you to someone else and of going in then with a targeted proposition, with a call that tries to be caring with maybe a better offer, and so on and so forth.
We had a lot of discussion here internally. Also, like I think what you say, like you in the models where you can afford more of a human touch, like in commercial banking, private banking, you see probably a little bit more of kind of that more subtle, more impactful kind of intel triggering conversation types. In retail, it's always been a little bit more difficult. I think in retail also, we basically try to automate the human intervention or support completely out of the mix, so it becomes fully automated. So it felt like rather strange if you have a bank with, let's say, 5 million customers and they all have the same one-size-fits-all app, right? And it's just a transactional servicing app. So I don't know what's going on, but but that would be a gold mine if you could take that app, and that app would be more dynamic, and you could able to tailor that, you know, ultimately maybe to the segment of one. So I think there must be something. I think also McKinsey is talking about the mobile app as kind of the front routing center to kind of basically drive intelligence as support and et cetera. So there must be something in, at least in the consumer context, that the highest frequency is with the mobile app, right? So that is the piece of real estate that potentially could change the equation.
100%. So let me just react to one thing you said. We do not believe that you should take the human factor completely out of it, even in retail. I mean, There are situations where it's very important to be there as a human, whether it is remote or in person. Depends on preferences. But that also, we wouldn't say that there shouldn't be any banking branches, right? I mean, if I'm a digital bank without branches today, I probably wouldn't build any, although some neobanks are thinking about it. But if I have them, it is an asset if I use them.
But that also then means that ideally kind of in that mobile app, you have to have some sort of a routing mechanism that you know. Like, how do you connect it to the right?
I couldn't agree more. So our data is very clear. Touch points are massively shifting towards the mobile app. It is by far the most used channel, by far, and gives banks many more touch points than they used to have. In some customer segments, more than people have with e-commerce providers and so on. And this is very valuable, eyeballs on an app, right? Where you could even think about other ways to monetize it, right? There's the first experiments of, putting advertising and so on. But it can be very targeted. Of course, you have to protect your brand and so on, but it's one thing. But your point was different. Your point was around the mobile app as an orchestrator. And we do think, we call it integrated channels. We do think that this is the future, that the mobile app will become the first entry point from which you, once you've authenticated in your app, then directly, talk to a voice bot or chatbot you can do things yourself in the app. The app allows you to connect with your advisor or someone with the skills required to help you in your moment. You can do it straight from there. The app potentially has views on your financial health and gives you recommendations. And I agree with you that this needs to be dynamic and personalized because the needs of customers are very different. And if I, an app like this for, my mother should look very different than for my brother, who's a few years younger than I am. I mean, they love each other very much, but they have fundamentally different needs and interests. And also any upsell or cross-sell or vouchers you put in there shouldn't be the same for these two customers. They need to be different. And that is not easy technologically, but I'm sure you're going to tell me it is possible. And I think that's clearly what we're going to. If this is the channel, it cannot be a one-size-fits-all thing.
Yeah, clear. Absolutely. But that kind of, in a way, it also means that, like, just like the trend we saw with social media platforms like WhatsApp or Instagram, Facebook, like, you basically are in the core in that platform. You have all the data, all the behavior is routing there. It would be a massive opportunity for banks, of course, to tap into that. Basically, what you need to change is, okay, the mobile app and the platform supporting the mobile app is basically the orchestrator. It is the conductor. I think also if you think about tailored value proposition, you can go beyond banking, or you can actually take different product categories within the banking domain, maybe slightly outside of the banking domain. They all have different attributes. So there's almost like an e-commerce / assembly type of opportunity to bring that, to do that matchmaking.
100%. But you remember earlier today we spoke about why some don't move, right? And what you just said is a massive opportunity, but it's not easy, right? And you do need a certain scale for it as well. So I can understand if I'm the head of retail at, some small regional institution somewhere, and I'm sitting there with, 500,000 customers or so, I'm probably figuring I don't want to be the first one trying this, right? Let's see what the others do. And then I do a fast follower strategy in a few years and see what works, and I don't, waste my very scarce resources and even to do something like this. But for bigger ones that want to also compete head to head with the likes of Monzo, Revolut, and so on, I agree with you. They should massively invest into this. If this becomes the primary channel of customer interaction, it needs to be personalized. It needs to have more powerful. It needs to solve more things directly. It needs to be able to, you know, separate the simple transactions and self-service tasks from the high value opportunities where someone, you know, is in the market for something and might need financing, or where someone has had a life event and should think about saving for their kids, this kind of stuff.
Yeah. So in a way, if I can summarize it, we basically say we have been working for 10 years or maybe a little bit more to kind of get mobile apps to become the primary interaction platform. Conclusion then is today they are mostly servicing apps. You see your transactions, your accounts, you do your payments. And the big opportunity for the next 10 years is to transform that into a growth platform. We have all the data, we can aggregate, we can make tailored value propositions, we can match products, and then we can right-size that to the customer. You say obstacles to get there, to get into that growth platform, right? It probably scale. So in a way, we might say, think like, you need to be JP Morgan who can afford to have a 2,000 engineers, data scientists, they can pull it off. Or hopefully there will be players that will democratize these type of technologies. And you see that a lot, for instance, in the US, where people are way more utilizing SaaS providers to help them. So you see relatively small institutions that run in a cloud-based platform, and they can, to a degree, compete with the bigger guys. I think there's definitely that democratization aspect, maybe. Do you see that, or do you have a different view? Because otherwise...
I agree with you. I mean, we spoke earlier about, you know, hurdles to moving faster. And I think there's many things coming together. Right? There's a history of having run into issues with the regulator, which makes management teams very cautious. There's a strong pressure to, you know, even find the funds to do all your run the bank activities to keep the ship running in a proper way. There is the massive transformation you need to do on your physical sales force, where you need to, you know, modernize your branch footprint, think about your SME centers across the country, scale up remote. There's a million things you need to do that probably distract you from something as fundamental and revolutionary as what we are discussing here. No? And again, I'm not saying this to say banks shouldn't do it, the opposite. But I do understand the individual manager who sometimes is my client, who, you know, says, yes, I want to do this, but I also need to do bam, 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 bam. And I just, with the teams that I have, the capabilities I have, and the money I have, I just don't manage to do it. So I understand it. However, I think the ones who crack that nut will see significant excess growth and benefit significantly. So I certainly encourage my clients to move faster on this.
This kind of triggers something like about how do you prioritize this whole big punch list, right? On one end, we now live, let's say, like we have this massive opportunity where the mobile app is the growth platform of the future. And to your point, like if you could do customer lifetime orchestration, you could really collect the data. You could really drive customer lifetime value. To your point, it's a super sticky business over a period of 20 years. Like the total customer value is a fantastic business model. Next to that, modernization, progressive modernization, now accelerated by AI. I think for the first time with these kind of AI coding agents, we have a real shot where in the past we probably would kick the can. We kicked the can for decades, right? But hopefully we're now. And so I'm just wondering, maybe you can tell a little bit about like how do you kind of see the prioritization of all these opportunities, right? Where things in the past we would talk about hyper personalization, but it was very hard to effectively truly do it, like a Google, or we've been talking about progressive modernization, but we basically don't do it.
I think we have to look at it institution by institution. For some institutions, it would be too much, and they can't do it. They shouldn't do it. They should focus on these things. Some institutions are working on it as we speak, right? I mean, we are doing a lot of work across Europe on the topic of hyper-personalization, which is exactly that question. And at times, it is focused on the app. And other times it is just focused on other marketing channels. Just building a central engine that makes it much easier for marketeers to send to a very small, much more targeted audience the right thing, the right visual, with the right action call out, with the right offer, and so on. And so that is happening for some, and they are moving very fast. And I think, I don't know if you are banking with these institutions, but you will most likely see different kind of offers coming your way, even as a customer, in the near future, right? And I'm sure some of these are your clients as well. And there's a third group of ones in the middle where I agree with you, where they should be doing the same thing, because I do think it's now possible. I see it's now possible. And for some reason, it gets stuck in between items 6 and 7. And again, it goes back to, you know, a number of things. Short time horizon of some of the management team. Maybe also missing understanding of tech. In many banks' management teams, there are still very few people who really understand technology. I myself personally also, I don't have a tech background. You know, I've worked very hard to get a layman's understanding of it, but I'm by no means a techie. And so, you know, not having that experience makes it more difficult. You know, history and struggle with the regulator who is very tough on new things that go wrong is an issue. So there's a bunch of things holding people back. Also limited or you know, subpar performance in past attempts to do new things based by maybe working with the wrong providers, maybe having low capabilities internally. So, and that's all these things. And that's one more thing, which I think is interesting, which is, many banks have for the last, you know, 20 years, maybe even more probably, heavily outsourced on IT. Heavily. I mean, throughout, but also IT. To a degree that there's there are incredible ratios now in some institutions of externals compared to internal IT. Where in some cases, it's not only the hands that are external, but also the capability. And some institutions lack the capability now to even steer what they have. So they're completely caught in a situation where there's a provider that any change they want to do needs to be done by the provider. And they're not even in a position to assess whether the resources put against it are the right level by a factor of 2. And I think they're getting fleeced on this. And I do see some institutions fighting back and working on strongly internalizing again. Not all of it. That also wouldn't make sense. But at least the power to control this zoo of external providers. And I think that's the right thing. That for banks is, by the way, it's very difficult, right? You need to, this kind of talent is picky. I'm sure you know, right? You are looking for the same talent in a tough market in Amsterdam. So attracting the talent is not easy, and it's particularly difficult for banks who don't have the best reputation as an employer, not anymore at least. That's another big priority for many.
Hey, Max, I think you perfectly outline, like say, all these understandable reasons why it is difficult for people to change, right? So maybe I have to also then ask the subsequent question is like, what is your experience? Like our audience has, we typically like to talk with change makers. So these people actually would like to say, maybe you can, your thought about how can we, because most of this stuff is actually related to run the bank, right? You basically how to run it, how to run the regulator or interact with the regulator, how to optimize the branch network, but basically to change the bank and the different opportunities we've been discussing. Are effective ways to kind of get out of the run hijack into allocating more talent and money into the change?
Yeah. Oh, man, you are asking tough questions. Yeah, because had I known this. No, but I think it's a very good question. So my answer, I think, won't surprise you. But I think it's a combination of a burning platform and a sense of urgency, which I think should be there. As we said in the beginning, it's a little bit hidden now with all the tailwinds coming from interest income and so on. But the sense of urgency should be there if you just open your eyes, look outside and see the stuff that some competitors are doing. That's number one. Number two, I think it's a lot about belief and believing that this can work. So I think what you need to do is to, in limited scope, create a success case where you do something new and it just works and is better than how you used to do things before. And if you are able to create that success case and you start building that belief, you can start a revolution, even in an institution, maybe among all institutions, banks are the least likely to start revolutions, but even there, because people love success, right? And in banks, many people care a lot about making things better, helping their customers, seeing customers be happy, seeing NPS scores goes up. These are not, you know, heartless bankers like in a Wall Street movie. These are people who care about customers and they want to serve the customers better. And they are in many cases, the bank employees are the most frustrated by unnecessary complexity and processes and so on. But you need that success case in limited scale that then can, you know, get people to believe that this is possible. Then you roll it out more broadly and you take more use cases on board and so on and so forth.
So, yeah, if I kind of summarize it, there is clearly a burning platform, but people don't feel the heat, maybe.
But let me ask you, right? I mean, let me ask you this, because I think you are, I mean, it's almost your job, right? You go out, you talk to financial institutions and you try to, you know, make them believe that moving faster, being more customer oriented and, you know, completely upgrading your interaction model with customers is possible, right? So what are the situations where this works? And maybe there's some patterns here you see as to which institutions are faster than picking this up. And I guess success here is not that you sell your thing, but that they start, you know, that they start moving.
No. It's almost like it's a meeting of the minds or it's a disconnect of the minds. As in, what I'm trying to say here is that we don't understand, of course, all the dynamics, but we started to kind of see a clear correlation to change in leadership where people have at least a horizon of 5 years to make impact. Where the people where we match, we clearly see that they are making changes in their leadership team where there's a more progressive CIO, a chief. They really kind of start to assemble a leadership team where people do understand technology and potentially come from other industries to drive that agenda. So I think I really think this starts at the C-suite. It starts there with the type of attitude. I think culture eats strategy for breakfast, because I think everything we discuss is logical. It makes sense. It's more, is there the belief and is there the willpower to actually embark on something that is not per se always going to be easy. I think there's also, we didn't discuss it, but there's maybe also a risk element in it where, to your point, it's just convenient to retire or it's just too convenient to run it. And, you know, maybe someone, I think it correlates with leadership.
Is that how you think about how you prioritize the, you know, the conversations you're having in your own internal sales pipeline?
But insight may be also nice for the audience. But I think if you think from the back-based go-to-market point of view, where we are driving change in the industry, we have to think about what is the ideal customer profile. And like the type of thing we do is strategic. The type of thing we do is we solve an existential problem for banks. Like if you do not go to a platform model, ultimately, I think ultimately we're right. It's more about like how much kind of adoption can you get with brave people that are basically willing to go and change the run versus change balance. The opportunities are there, like the capabilities are there. We are looking for that as the main criteria. You have to go to the top, and at the top, there needs to be a horizon with people that are driving a change program.
So I would say that anyone who gets a call from you, you know, can already feel, you know, can feel a bit honored that they make it to your criteria of being someone who's bold enough. And, you know, it's good. You know, I mean, no. So
yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
The ones who don't get a call should probably reflect a bit on their own leadership.
I suggest that. Yeah.
I'm going to wrap us up with a few key takeaways. I'm trying to summarize all the different angles of the conversation we had just now.
We will rate you on whether you paid attention.
Please do. Please do. This is my annual performance review right here, right now.
Oh, let's go. Excellent.
So we started the conversation, Max, with the fact that basically the statement is universal banking players are facing pressure. They're pressured on their growth, they're pressured on their margin, and they do see a hollowing out of market share, given the direct competitors that are entering in the different domains, in the different sub line of business contexts, where you basically see a shifting dynamic. So there is an urgency to renew the business, renew the model, renew the operating model, and potentially also technology. Then we had a sub-discussion on, so how do you unlock growth? And you basically made the statement, you need to refocus on granular growth. Like, what are the smaller subsegments that you can really organize yourself against and really be a differentiating player and hence have a certain impact in the market? Which led us to discussing tailored value propositions, segment of one, hyper-personalization. How do you get to a level where the experience is just second to none, just like any of the big tech experiences that you are all familiar with? We then moved on to the need of modernization. Like, you have to modernize at any given moment to improve the efficiency internally, but also to actually unlock the growth potential to bring those types of experiences to the table that really allow you to, you know, stand out and differentiate. We didn't call it as such, but to me, I was listening to an e-commerce of banking story. It was more growth hacking. Like, you have a high CAC, customer acquisition cost. If you acquire the customer at this moment in time and you retain them for 20 years, you're in a very healthy business. If you acquire them and they leave through the back door, you have a real issue. And actually, because the unit economics are under pressure, it's going to get more intense. And that's the coming few years right there for you. And then lastly, we talked a little bit about the prevention of churn, right? Easily forgotten. Like, how do you ensure that when you have the signals that there are customers that are on their way out, that you can actually act? Which was a very nice discussion also where Jouk mentioned, yeah, theoretically, you have all the data, you have all the scientists and so forth, but I don't see it as much. There are clearly a few examples that you are working with, Max, but I think for the vast majority, this is more of a dream still, where of course we talked about a few recommendations on how to make progress. How did I do, Max?
I think you passed, no?
Man, yes. Tim, unbelievable. Even on the morning after the Christmas party, so bright.
Absolutely.
It's unbelievable.
By the way, both of you, in good shape.
Well,
that's maybe the external view. The internal view is very different. I'm happy. I'm happy that lunch is coming up soon. Anything you would add, Max? Anything that I missed out on, or you feel like, hey, if there's one thing you want to walk away with, this is the thing.
No, I think we also discussed primacy for a while, which I think links to many of the things you said. And again, it's cross-selling has been a long story in banking for a long time. It's been very elusive. But the focus on primacy that I'm now seeing with many of my clients is intense. I do see things moving. I mean, that's one last idea, maybe. This whole idea of, a loyalty-style system, right, that was en vogue in banking 15 years ago, and for a long time we haven't spoken about this. But in different shapes and forms, it's coming back, right? How do you, how do you create a real partnership with your clients? Where you, the ones who, give you more business and, really make you their primary provider, you also give them something in return. And there's a lot of experimentation going around on this. And I think that's good.
That's kind of then also kind of based on relationship-based pricing, incentives, just to kind of make it all kind of attractive. If you, the more you take, the better the package.
Yeah, now Tim is getting nervous. We were already done. He had wrapped us up. And now we are restarting again.
This basically means we're going to re-invite you to the pod, Max. Thank you so much for joining and sharing your insight. It's been fun. And I would say good luck getting the Christmas present.
No. I want to make a public statement here. Of course, I was only joking. I have organized everything for weeks. It's all here. No worries.
No worries. Cool. Happy holidays.
Thank you so much.
Happy holidays. Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Banking Reinvented, a podcast by Backbase. Make sure to follow both Jouk and myself on LinkedIn, where we will be sharing key insights about our journey towards modernizing banking.